everyone. We'd like to call to order the regularly scheduled monthly meeting of the District of Columbia Board of Pharmacy. Today is April 4th, 2019, and the time is 9:39. This is our open session, and we'll begin our meeting by having members of the board as well as our staff members introduce ourselves, and then we will ask members of the public to do the same. Please remember to sign the sign-in sheet that's going around, and in your introduction, if you are affiliated with any organization, then please include that in your introduction. So I will begin. I'm Daphne Bernard, board member.
Good morning. James Appleby, board member.
Tamara McCants, board member.
Shakita Sanders, board member.
Benjamin Miles, board member.
Staff present.
Shauna White, executive director.
Good morning. Corinne Barron, health license specialist.
Good morning. Lou Bernard, board member.
AJ Gold, filling in for Carla Williams.
Okay, thank you. And so now we'll ask members of the public to please introduce yourselves. We'll begin here.
Ashley Bowe, Walgreens.
Okay.
Don Zawater, DC Public.
Chris Keyes, Emily, and Pharmacy Associates.
Thank you.
Scarlett Zara, Summit Williams.
Angela Bryant, CBS.
Daniel J., Walmart.
Okay, Stanford, Kaiser Permanente.
Thank you, and welcome. Okay, so we'll start off by having approval of our open session meeting minutes. And just for the record, we do have a quorum so that we can handle all business matters that come before the board today. So members of the board, if you have an opportunity, please review the open session meeting minutes from February the 7th as well as March the 7th. Note any corrections that we might need to make, and when you're ready, we will entertain a motion to approve.
At the same time?
It might be a good idea to do them separately because there's some members who might not have been present for one of them.
Okay.
So, yeah, we'll start with February the 7th.
I'll move approval of the February 7th, 2019 Board of Pharmacy open session minutes as presented.
Okay, is there a second?
Second.
Okay. Is there a general consensus in favor of the motion? Any discussion? All in favor say aye. Any opposed? Abstentions, the motion carries. Now for the March the 7th minutes.
I move that we approve the March open session minutes.
All right,
second.
All right, any discussion? Is there general consensus in favor of the motion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Abstentions? The motion carries. Thank you for that. Next item is review of the consent agenda, and seeing that there is none, we will move to our executive director's report. Dr. White.
All right. Good morning, everyone. Can you all hear me, or you all prefer me to stand up?
Good.
Okay, I'm going to stand up because I have a lot of information to give, and I want to make sure Mr. Zawada has to get him the right numbers. Good morning. So for our statistics, currently now we have 1,951 pharmacists licensed in the District of Columbia, 603 pharmacists have vaccination and immunization authority. We have 651 pharmacy interns, 766 pharmacy technicians, 98 pharmacy technician trainees, 11 pharmacy technician training programs, and 770 pharmaceutical detailers. I wanted to provide some renewal statistics so you all know how many pharmacists and pharmacy technicians renewed during the renewal period that closed February the 28th. So 1,904 pharmacists renewed their pharmacist license. Of those pharmacists, 575 had authority to provide vaccination and immunizations, and we had 769 pharmacy technicians renew. So our renewal period closed February 28th, 2019. However, if a pharmacist or pharmacy technician still needs to renew their license, they can renew under the late period, and that late period will end April 30th, 2019. It will be an additional late fee. It'll be an additional fee of $85, which is the late fee. After April 30th, they will need to fill out a reinstatement application. I wanted to provide everyone some updates for our prescription drug monitoring program. Can you raise your hand if you received an email from our department alerting everyone to the pending legislation that will require mandatory enrollment in a prescription drug monitoring program? Everybody received the email? That's great. Now, how many people have registered? Awesome. Thank you all. So I do have an update. That legislation is in congressional approval right now, so we anticipate in the next week or so that legislation is approved, and then after that we will be providing information when the deadline is to register. So if you have colleagues that you know that have not registered, please encourage them to register. And this is for any pharmacist with an active pharmacist license. So thank you all to those who have been proactive. I really appreciate it. I would like to encourage everyone to get their colleagues to renew. Right now, the vets have the highest percentage of practitioners registered, and they see animals. So I really want to encourage them that we can do a better job than the vets and get everyone registered. They have a small amount of practitioners. However, we still need to do better than the vets because we are pharmacists. So please encourage your colleagues to register with the prescription drug monitoring program. Also, we have been reaching out to entities in the district, whether that's hospitals and also pharmacies, about integration into our prescription drug monitoring program, integrated into the pharmacy management system. So if you're not aware that your organization received any information, please contact us at doh.pdmp@dc.gov, and we can direct you to the appropriate information on our website to initiate those conversations between our prescription drug monitoring vendor and your company's IT team. So we have a lot of information up on that PDMP website now concerning the integration. So if you or your company is interested, please let us know if you have not received any information. I did want to mention the Mayor's Opioid Strategic Plan, Live Long DC. They are re-releasing that website, so that website should be live in the next week or so. So if you are interested in the Mayor's Strategic Plan, I think it's livelongdc.gov, and you will find information there. It's a good website. As far as the Clinical Lab Practitioner Advisory Committee, one of the members was supposed to come to update the Board of Pharmacy at the meeting today, but we'll have them come in June because they won't be able to make it. So they're still working together to advise the board on the practice of clinical lab practitioners. I want to give an NABP update. The National Association of Boards of Pharmacy annual meeting is May, let me make sure I get the dates. It's the 15th and 16th in Minneapolis, Minnesota. We will have representation there from three of our board members. So hopefully we will be bringing back a lot of information to the public about what's going on in NABP. We'll have that information to provide at the June meeting. I wanted to also mention the DEA National Take Back is April the 27th. You can go to DEA's website to find more information and the take back locations. So if your organization does not currently have a take back box, and you know that some of your patients are coming in asking about drug disposal, there's a big nationwide take back day, April the 27th. And there will be locations throughout the District of Columbia. So I think that is it for all of my announcements.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. Any questions for Dr. White? No? Okay. Thank you again for that. Next item is the Assistant General Counsel report. AJ, I think, will provide.
I just have, like I said, just a brief announcement. Carla is going to update you more at the May meeting regarding new requirements in continuing education, specifically the public health continuing education requirement. What I wanted to pass out to you is just a list that I've, since I also work with the Board of Medicine and the Board of Podiatry, they found it helpful just to get a heads up into like what kinds of categories the public health continuing education hours will be in. So there should be more news coming shortly, but basically it will be a requirement for all professionals to do 10% of their continuing education hours in the categories that are determined by the director of the Department of Health and the executive directors. And what you have in front of you are some of the possible buckets that might be determined to be in those categories. Like I said, every board will come up with its categories based on what the director or the administration decides. She should have more information at the May meeting because you'll have to change your regulations to put the new requirement in there.
Can I get some? First of all, thank you for providing.
Sure,
this. I think
welcome.
It's really helpful.
Sure.
Is it 10% or 10 CE?
10%. 10% of what you require.
So our previous CE requirements would change to this instead. Is that correct?
This would be an addition to what you currently have.
Oh, okay.
Because
yeah.
I see med errors here.
Yeah.
We're already doing two in med errors.
Yeah, but that's 5%.
Yeah. And HIV is here as well.
Oh, okay.
I think this would take the place of the requirement. The HIV requirement and the Medicare requirement.
Right, but the LGBTQ would still remain because that's a statutory requirement.
Okay.
So it'll still be 4 hours because it'll be 10%.
Okay.
So currently right now we have 2 hours in HIV and 2 hours in Medicare.
But hopefully, yeah.
Okay.
All right, so may I ask a couple questions?
Sure.
So question one, where did this come from?
This is, I don't know if okay, do you want to add to it, but this is an initiative from the director of DC
right.
Health. For all professionals.
Right.
Is it a law or is it an administrative regulation directive, whatever you want to call it in legal terms?
It'd be a requirement to change it via administrative regulation. Like I said, the director has the authority to determine continuing education requirements for all professionals. So every board would have to change its regulations to incorporate this new requirement.
And was there input from any of the licensing boards about the merits of such an approach?
That I'm not sure about. Yeah.
Okay, I can answer that. To clarify, you had said that these are the 10 categories that came down from the Director of Health, but then you said each board will get to decide the categories.
Once,
so which is it?
Once the categories are finalized, each board would then be able to determine through its executive director what the final categories or what the final buckets would be. So there'd be 10. To 12 general categories.
Uh-huh.
But as you can see, some of these categories would not apply to this board. Some categories would not apply to other licensing boards. So you would choose the categories that would be most appropriate for your licensing.
And we can choose as many of them as we want.
Exactly.
For our board. Okay.
Exactly.
And to be clear, is this intended? This does not replace anything. That this is an overlay. Now, which is to say, we still have to get 2 hours of HIV. It could meet this requirement, but if we don't get 2 hours of HIV, but we get 10 hours of ethics, it doesn't replace our need to get the HIV requirement. So we'll make sure we're not replacing. They could serve double duty, but we're not replacing.
Right. We'll get some more clarification on this, but from my understanding, this will replace the HIV and Medicare requirement because, from my understanding, these lists or the topics are coming down to ensure that the practitioners' requirements reflect what's kind of going on in the District of Columbia. So instead of the Medicare and the HIV, it would be something from this list that you would take. The LGBTQ still stays, but it will be something from the list right here.
Yeah, I think I think we'll get some additional clarification, but clearly this is...
And when does it
as soon as your board attorney promulgates the regulation and it gets passed. Several boards have already had their regulations amended. I know I work with the Board of Medicine. We're in the process of regulating it. They had some of the same questions that you had, that they thought that this was an additional requirement. What we tried to explain to them is that the continuing education that they're already doing every cycle, most if not all of the classes or courses they're taking would already be incorporated in the categories that are listed.
Do you know the time frame for implementation, and then what happens when there's a new director?
Well, I mean, it's like I said, because this is a regulation, like if a new director decided to edit, amend, modify, you know, eliminate the requirement, that have to be done by regulation also.
Is this up for discussion? Are they obtaining feedback, or this is just what it's going to be?
I think several boards have already amended the regulations, so it's already happening.
Okay.
Do you have any feedback?
Well, I think that based on the list, I'm not sure if other boards may not have been as proactive as we were as a board of pharmacy, but based on the list, a lot of it, we're already covered. So it almost seems like, why is this being put forth? I guess I want more of a rationale, but I mean, if it's a directive, it's a directive. We'll just go from there.
Well, and that's like I said, if you're already doing it, you're already sort of ahead of the curve. Some of the other boards did not have, I guess, the same impetus for public health continuing education. So it's sort of an impetus to try to make sure all professionals have some public health training and continuing education.
Having a degree in public health, I would say I'm very much in support of public health-related education for all individuals who are professionals. And I also see no emergency around this, and I'm disappointed that there wasn't consultation with the professional licensing boards. There's a certain phrase, nothing, no conversation about us without us, and that's what we have, and I'm disappointed that the opportunity, because it was not an emergency, was not taken to consult with the licensing boards. I know you have no control of that whatsoever, but I want to express that in public.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Appleby. Any other questions or comments? All right. I did have a question about the CPR training policy statement. Do we have that posted, or where are we with that?
It's a draft.
The draft. Mm-hmm. Okay. Are we ready to approve it today? Colleagues, is that something that you think we might be ready to do, or you want to table it for the next meeting?
We can do it.
So you can find this on page number 20. So just for the public, so that everyone is clear, the board is putting together some clarification around the CPR requirement for vaccination and immunization authority, being very clear that I would like to read the statement if I can. Hold on a second. So basically, the statement clarifies that certification in cardiopulmonary resuscitation for healthcare providers requirement, CPR course, must be met through completion of a live course. The board will not accept a CPR course that is completed online in whole or in part. And so that's the intent of the policy statement that we are looking at approving.
Have a question. I have not ever renewed my CPR with the online portion. but my understanding is that some courses have like an online portion and then you can still do the demonstration.
Yeah.
So have any of you all ever done that? And is there any reason why? But I think that in the initial discussion we talked about it in whole, but I don't agree necessarily with the in part portion. I don't know. Can anybody explain the rationale for that, or can you?
I thought that the intent of this was to make sure that somebody had the opportunity to demonstrate their skills,
yeah,
and not just complete the CPR course completely online. I think that after doing the course that has a didactic portion online, and then you go in and demonstrate your skills to test out, I don't see why that would also be appropriate.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Okay. So it looks like this is something that we may want to continue to take a look at before approving, unless we're ready to make an amendment.
Yeah,
to
can
the,
we? That's all I want to know. Sure. Can we just make an amendment?
I think so. I mean, you have some
words you'd like to.
I want to amend. Yeah, take out the or in part.
Well, you also have to take out that the sentence right above it as well that says must be met through completion of a live course.
Okay. Yeah. So let's.
You have to modify that.
Yeah. Okay. So it's just not to take up so much time. Let's just go back, because I think that the intent is to ensure that the participant does the.
Live demonstration.
Right. And so I would like some time to actually find the correct wording for that.
Very good.
Instead of trying to rush through it.
Okay. So just again, just to make it clear, so right now the board is not prepared to approve that statement. We're going to take another look at the language and consider a portion of the training to be online, since that is currently a practice that many of our pharmacists are taking advantage of. And so we'll revisit this at another time. Okay. So the next item on our agenda, we're going to our subcommittee reports. And so we have Ben Miles, who will be presenting the legislative subcommittee and regulatory report.
Thank you. So we have been working on the Defending Access to Women's Healthcare Services Amendment Act, and we have been meeting as a subcommittee with the Board of Pharmacy and the Board of Medicine over several meetings. We have completed the draft regulations and are waiting for one final review by the committee before sharing it with the boards to get official approval. And the algorithm is in, hold on, let me see. Okay, so we've completed the self-assessment and referral forms for oral contraceptives and are making some minor tweaks to that. And then the last step that we're waiting on is completion of the algorithm that will help to guide pharmacists to prescribe oral contraception. And that is where we are right now. We have a meeting pending, and hopefully we'll have this coming before both boards soon.
Thank you. Anything else?
No. We also have convened a collaborative practice task force that is composed of a few Board of Medicine and Board of Pharmacy members. We are in the process of establishing a list of duties that a pharmacist may complete by a collaborative practice agreement that can be pre-approved by both boards, that won't require a specific collaborative practice agreement to go before both boards. So that would be things like warfarin dosing that pharmacists do regularly, just as an example. So that wouldn't require special approval by both boards. And things outside of that list would have to come before both boards for approval. So we've met one time to begin the process of establishing a list of standard things that a pharmacist can do And we'll have more to come on that soon.
Thank you. So just to clarify, especially because I know we have at least one student, I think, in the audience. Yes. So the collaborative practice task force that's currently doing some work, they're actually taking a look at what will be recognized as standard or acceptable collaborative agreements between prescribers and pharmacists. What's the list? What are the list, like hypertension, drug therapy management, anti-coag, maybe asthma? What are those things that they've, you know, pharmacists have been working with prescribers for years and doing these, so that once we have that list, anyone who wishes to enter into a collaborative practice agreement, if you're doing something that's on that approved list, fine. If it's something beyond what's considered like routine collaborative practice, then that has to come before the Board of Pharmacy and the Board of Medicine for consideration. Does that make sense? So I wanted to make sure that everyone is clear on exactly where this collaborative practice task force, where we are. And I never can miss an opportunity to really thank Ben, Mr. Appleby, Alan Freeman, the wonderful work. And I think, Tamara, you're still kind of involved with the Legislative and Regulatory Subcommittee. This is a hardworking group of board members that really spent a lot of time trying to make sure that pharmacists, our colleagues in the District of Columbia, our hands are not tied, and we're able to do some of the great things that we can to advance patient care, but at the same time, we're doing it in a responsible manner that protects the public. And there's a lot of work with the Board of Medicine, a lot of collaboration with the Board of Medicine when we talk about, you know, a lot of these things, especially collaborative practice. So kudos, thank you for the hard work, and we're looking forward to making even more progress. Question for you, I don't want to put you on the spot. Right now, do you know how many states where pharmacists are allowed to prescribe contraceptives? Any idea where that is?
It is somewhere in the neighborhood of six,
like five,
seven,
or six.
Yeah.
Like Maryland, Alaska, Oregon.
So Maryland, California. Is there already?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Maryland, Alaska, California, Oregon.
You got to say Washington. Is
Washington, Colorado.
Okay. Colorado, I think like a handful.
Yeah.
Definitely less than 10.
Okay, curious to know that. Thank you. Okay. Any questions or anything for our Legislative and Regulatory Subcommittee before we move on? No? All right. The next item will be our Communications Subcommittee report. And I think the thing that I want to suggest, just for consideration, maybe we can do like a email blast, and Dr. White, you're probably already in the process of doing this, but it was my first time hearing about the April 30th. No, what is it? I wrote down April 30th, the renewal extension period. I just wonder, would it be helpful for us to email the pharmacists and remind them that, you know, renewal closed, the regular renewal period closed February the 28th. The late period closes April 30th. And then after that, you have to apply for a reinstatement. I'm hoping my colleagues know that, because I So maybe, do you think it's a good idea to email, or probably not necessary?
We can send a reminder email for those practitioners.
Yeah, I think that might be an important communication. And maybe in that communication, we might want to include the information about registering your entity with PDMP if they so desire to do so. And the DEA take-back part. Maybe like just like a little brief email that hits a few important things that are happening now as a communication and go out to the pharmacists. But we can, I guess we can kind of talk. If it's a good idea, great. If there's
we'll see what we can do. Okay. Maybe send something by the end of next week.
Okay. And just as a reminder, everyone, the DEA drug take-back day, April 27th. And I don't know if anyone has tried it, but apparently Google Maps is now including the what do you call it? The drop off, the prescription med drop, what do they call it? Yeah, the drug disposal sites. So pretty soon, if it's not happening now, you'll be able to go on Google and find your nearest drug disposal location. I think that's pretty neat. I didn't try it to see if it's working now, but if it's not working now, that should be happening pretty soon. I think that's going to be kind of important. Not everyone is going to be able to get out on April the 30th, but it's a good idea for everyone to know where they can drop off their unused meds. Okay. The next thing on our agenda is the NABPE newsletters, but because we had like a lot of appearances scheduled, I didn't want to take up too much time to go over those things. I did want to mention the drug disposal site that'll be on Google Maps, and I think everyone knows about the recall on Losartan tablets. Yeah, and I think those are probably the most important things that we might have wanted to cover here. All right. I think it's okay to go to the next item, unless there are any questions, comments, no? Okay, so the next item is EO5. We received a letter from a military spouse in regards to licensure issues that not only his wife, I think he really is looking at the bigger picture here. He's been looking at this since 2017, quite frankly, but the issue that he has brought forth to all of the state boards is if you're married to someone in the military and you're a pharmacist and you have to move when they are relocated, having to then get a license in that new state within a reasonable time frame so that you can continue to work and help, you know, provide for your family has been an issue. Now, what I find interesting, I wasn't quite clear on what the gentleman was asking. He did note that there's some states that give somewhat of a window where a person can work for like maybe 60 or 90 days until they then get a license. But I wasn't sure what the ask was, quite frankly. And so when matters are brought before the board, we discuss them during open session. And again, this is something that he sent to all of the state boards, not just the DC Board of Pharmacy. So for board colleagues, I'm interested in hearing what your thoughts are on this. I do want to note, and I don't want to simplify the matter, but I think it is understandable if you work for a federal institution, you can have a license. As long as you're licensed in one state, you're fine. However, you know, he did note particularly like a couple of retail pharmacies, which aren't federal institutions, and so maybe, you know, the thought is, well, you shouldn't just, you know, be hindered to, you know, only federal places to work. So, any thoughts, concerns?
Well, I would just observe it as you did, and even in the case that's provided here, this pharmacist spouse has found employment in some cases, on some duty stations inside the federal sector, so they're quite aware of that opportunity. I don't know that there's anything the board can do per se other than pass this forward to whoever's head of the health committee and see if they have any interest in taking it up. It's outside our purview, sensitive to the issue, but would require change in law.
Federal law.
So DC could pass a law to enable it, as other states have. It's very kind. There's a lot of wonderful information there. So if DC wants to take it up, great, but it wouldn't be a Board of Pharmacy issue.
That was exactly Carla's comment. She used the exact word. This is not under the board's purview. It's in the realm of advocacy, and that either would require a change in law or Shauna could tell them to contact the Pharmacy Association.
Do you have any other comment?
I just wanted to put on record that it's not just military spouses that, you know, may be subject to their spouses moving from state to state. You know, so if we made an exception for military spouses, then what about other people? There's several people that's in this type of situation, and really and truly the best way for them to combat this is to stay in the federal government system, which is probably the reason why places like the VA, et cetera, require that you just get one. You don't have to get a state licensure to work there. And especially in D.C., where we have so many federal places to work, like the FDA, et cetera, the VA, we're probably the most military-friendly place where someone can find a job.
Okay. Very good. Any more thoughts?
Can I just ask a question?
Yes.
How complicated is it for a person to get a license as it is right now? If you did absolutely nothing? I mean, this person is saying I'd like it to be easy.
Right.
So does that mean it's going to take 6 months or it's going to take a week or whatever? I mean, is it very complicated that this has to even be addressed? You can just say, go through the normal process and you'll be fine in a week.
It is fairly complicated. You have to apply to NABP for licensure reciprocity. You have to apply for a license in the state, both of which require fees. Then you have to take a law test for the specific state where you're trying to get a license, and then you can be licensed. So it's a matter of lots of fees and a test for each state. And it could take potentially a few months to do.
So I guess it kind of depends on how you look at it. Complicated, it's kind of relative. Because, and again, I don't want to oversimplify the matter. We have people who, they reciprocate to several states. If you know you're going to be moving someplace, and again, I don't know how military families know when they're going to move or how far in advance. But basically, you do apply through NABP, you apply with the state, you get your authorization to test, you study, you go take that MPJE, and you get your license. So there are steps involved. Some of them involve payment, but probably, you know, one of the significant things that I think a pharmacist, my colleagues would probably think about is having to take these exams. This exam, that exam. And so for some people, the studying and the passing those exams, we have some individuals that they have to take a law exam 3-4 times before they pass it. And so for that, I think that probably is the, you know, probably the bigger challenge of the issues. But the money, you know, that's not a small thing either. And then remember, once you get your license, you gotta, if you wanna keep it renewed, then those are payments that you have to pay each time as well. And so, yeah, so that there's some challenges there. But right now, the good news is his wife has been able to find a job, and she was able to convince the California State Board to not force her to take their law exam and the NAPLEX that it looked like at one point one state it might have required that. So there's some hurdles, but thank goodness they've been able to kind of overcome.
I think when you compare our licensure process or our reciprocity process to other healthcare professions, ours tends to be, it has more hurdles than other, like nursing may have to get a license in another state. And I think that's what they're getting.
Yeah, it definitely might be a good idea to approach the pharmacy associations and see if there can be greater advocacy. Kudos for him to him though for advocating for, you know, what happens with pharmacy. All right, next item, E06. And so there's an application for approval to provide LGBTQ cultural competency continuing education course for pharmaceutical detailers. And so as everyone in the audience probably knows, all healthcare professionals in the District of Columbia have to get at least 2 hours in LGBTQ continuing education training. There are not a lot of those programs that are out there. There are some out there. Most of them are not free. But this organization would like to be considered or approved to provide training specifically to the pharmaceutical detailers. And so to help us out with this, Corinne has included a CE guide. When reviewing applications, you can find it on page 80 so that we can kind of consider approving this program. I'm not sure if this is are we prepared to approve it now based on the guidelines, or is this something that needs to be revisited at the next meeting?
I know there are a number of things, Madam Chair, that the board empowers professional staff to handle, and we do that on an annualized basis. We just renew our intent to have matters handled that way. Is approval of these types of things something that the executive director handles, or are we, is this something we have to do with each time, has to be brought, every course has to be brought to the full board?
Well, two things. One, you can make a motion for us to have that authority to approve, but typically in the past, the pharmaceutical detail or continuing education was reviewed by Dr. McCant, because this is a new topic for detailers, the LGBTQ. We wanted to give the opportunity for the entire board to look at this course, because it's something a little different than the regular courses for that were, I guess, approved in the past.
So those other courses would have gone through the appropriate process with professional staff handling it. This is coming to us because it's outside the norm, because of the subject matter, because it's brand new in terms of our licensing requirement?
No. Mm-hmm. I've approved all the courses so far for the pharmaceutical detail.
Yeah.
So I wanted to... Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So you want to just continue?
Well,
to
I reviewed them, not necessarily approved them all, but I reviewed the ones that have come forth.
So are you willing to review this one as well?
I can review it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right.
So did the board want to make a motion to have continue, review the LGBTQ and all LGBTQs moving forward?
Well, it's not because it's LGBTQ, it's because it's pharmaceutical detailers, right?
Detailers, right.
And we've already made that motion, and you handle that already, right?
Mm-hmm. I'll make the motion.
Do we need another motion? I know. Go for it, Jim.
Dr. McKenzie will love me. I make a motion that Dr. McKenzie continue to review all board
pharmaceutical
detail requirements.
Okay. So there's a motion that's been made. Is there a second?
Second.
Any discussion? Or any more discussion? Is there general consensus in favor of the motion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Abstentions? The motion carries.
I was just going to add a quick comment. The Board of Medicine, I don't know if you allow it, but the Board of Medicine allows, there's two organizations that have videos online for LGBTQ. There's about 100 videos. One is from the Fenway Institute, the other one is from the Human Rights Campaign Foundation, and at the end of each video, you get a certificate of completion. And the best thing about it is all of the videos are free. You just have to register for an account.
Okay,
sit through the videos. So like I said, something the Board of Medicine, the Board of Chiropractic have done for this particular requirement.
Okay. I'd be interested in getting that link so that I can take a look at
it.
Yesterday I saw a post from the med school that they could get this particular LGBTQ CE on, I thought they said DCRX, for free if you use a certain code. So I want to check that out and see if that's an option as well.
That information would be helpful for the newsletter, not only now, but
absolutely,
in a year's time as people are getting closer to the next round of renewal. So is the Fenway Institute, what was the other one called?
Human Rights Campaign Foundation, and the other one is National LGBT Health Education Center Program of the Fenway Institute. They have about 100 two-hour videos, and all of them are free.
What I do wish we had, remember the specific requirements for this, it was very clear. Remember, we looked at it at the last board meeting. I'll try to find it again, because that's probably the most important thing. It needs to speak to the things that we said the content has to include. So that would be helpful.
No, I was going to say course participant or the healthcare professional would need to make sure they review the course syllabus to make sure that everything that's included in that course.
Mm-hmm.
I think the ones for pharmacists are ACPE approved and clearly the objectives. I'm not sure about the ones from Fenway Institute or the Health Educational Institute.
Human Rights Campaign Foundation. I'll email it to you too, Sean.
Okay, and we can look at it and then post those in the newsletter. I think they may be helpful.
Very good. All right. So you'll take a look at that training program and make a recommendation for approval at a later time. Right, Dr. McGinnis. Yes, thank you. All right. So the next item on our agenda is time for our public comments. And so before we begin our public comments, I saw a couple of people who came in and you were not given an opportunity to give us your name and any organization that you might be affiliated with. So if you can, I'd like to start here. With you, can you just tell us your name and if you're affiliated with any group?
Sure. Good morning, everyone. I'm Kim Greenwood. I'm a registered nurse. I work here in the building for DC Health. I work for the immunization program.
Thank you. Thank you. The gentleman in the back.
Good morning. My name is Jonas Terry, pharmacist with the Department of Health and Finance.
Okay. All right. Anyone else? Yes.
Hi, my name is Stephanie Howard. I'm a student visiting from Kaiser Permanente.
Okay, a student where?
At North Carolina University.
Okay, welcome, welcome. Is that everyone?
Yes.
All right. So now is the time for members of the public, if there are any questions or any feedback that you'd like to provide to us, we will welcome those at this time. We only ask that you stand and just remind us of your name if you're giving a comment. Yes. Dr. Keys.
Good morning again. At Sylvan Hospital, we have been impacted by the private practice agreement, which we're fully in support of, but just to bring it up to date, we have been operating under the previous provisions in the DC Pharmacy Practice Act that allow hospitals to have protocol-based practice by pharmacy, and we were doing so for warfarin, vancomycin, gentamicin, and parenteral nutrition. There is over 20 pharmacists who have been doing that historically. With the transition, with the changeover and the legislation that created put out the practice agreement in late August, I believe it was, of last year, we immediately responded to the legislation by revisiting all of our staffing patterns and those who immediately fit the requirements to be able to continue under the collaborative practice agreement under the new regulations versus those who do not. Over a third of the clinical pharmacists, even though some of them have been practicing with PharmDs for 10 years or more, don't immediately fit the criteria. So we literally had to change our staffing. We operate 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. We do over 200 consults a month under collaborative practice. We submitted, as we believe is outlined in the new regulations, our certificate programs for those four areas that have been used within the City Hospital and approved by medical staff to the board seeking to get feedback/approval so that our pharmacists who have been completed that training program could be reintroduced into their practice. So we're coming to the board now to give you feedback that we submitted in probably fall, maybe October, November, somewhere last year or that time, and we're still on hold. So we have a third of our staff who cannot do what we historically were doing, and it has increased the impact on those who use staff, and it has been a discouragement for those who had already reached that level of practice and training, but we tried it because we wanted to be in line with the regulations. So we're confident that the process is all going to work out. We realize this is new, but I think that we want the board to be aware that at least at one of the very active institutions in the area which conduct pharmacist-based protocols historically and have for years, we had to change our program dramatically. We asked our pharmacists to understand that we're going to work through this, but we're looking for some type of resolution so that we don't continue to literally write schedules every month based on revisions to our authorization of who can do this. And this is probably consistent with some other hospitals in the district because we have basically kind of three types of practitioners, those who are newly minted, with their PharmDs, often with their residencies, we have those. But within the 3 years, they're not authorized by the regulation. We have those who are several years with their board certification or certification in some area and have their 3 years. So they are already on board, and those are the ones who can do our work now. And then we have those who are often 5, 10, 15 years, almost all with PharmDs, and they've literally been sidelined on this on our work pending this action. So I want to make it clear that it's real for us at Sibley. It's probably real at other hospitals, but I'm not going to speak for them. And we just are looking for some type of a relief in terms of how we go forward so that we are able to fulfill the collaborative practice rights and continue to provide services, which frankly the medical staff has been depending on for years,
So thank you. Thank you, Dr. Keyes, for that feedback. Just so that everyone is clear, one of the things that's in the regulations is for, in order to be a pharmacist who is engaged in a collaborative practice, there must be some specialty training in that area that you're going to be practicing within. And so I think that what you might have provided some months ago is a training program that would be offered by Sibley, where your pharmacist would participate in that, and then you'd like for the board to consider that kind of training as being adequate enough for your pharmacist to be allowed to engage in collaborative practice. Question that I have for you, because right off I can't even remember what the training program proposal looked like. For the areas that these pharmacists have been not able to continue to practice in, what areas were those? Were they TPN?
Postpartum nutrition, writing, and monitoring by pharmacists, warfarin, dosing and monitoring, vancomycin, IV dosing and monitoring, and immunoglycoside dosing and monitoring.
Okay.
Those are the four areas.
All right. So I'm going to, and you said that was in October or so that?
Probably,
you guys,
I don't know exactly.
So,
October, November.
Yeah, so that's in a task force that the Board of Medicine is working on with the Board of Pharmacy. So that's all wrapped up in those conversations with the Board of Medicine. So just so everyone has an understanding of how collaborative practice works and how it's been working, those decisions have to come from a joint decision and joint agreement from both boards. So we understand your concerns, and we have expressed those concerns. So hopefully we can come up, and work with the Board of Medicine a little bit more closely. We already have let them know and did a lot of education about what pharmacists can do. So we do understand your concerns, and we definitely are working with them to have a resolution.
I actually want to take that a little step further and say that the Board of Pharmacy is actively advocating to educate the members of the task force from the Board of Medicine, so that they can be aware of what has been in practice for many years. So please know that as the members from the Board of Pharmacy that is on that task force, we are vehemently pressing forward to have our colleagues understand the capacity of what pharmacists can do and have those regulations reflect what's happening in the real world practice.
That's very helpful. I don't know if there is any way in which there would be some interim relief that could be established within this regulation, because all hospitals in the district are affected, and I think simply maybe it would catalyze our story very succinctly, but it's across the city. And we had a conversation with the president of the hospital, Dr. Zia. We actually debriefed him about this when it took place. He's a tremendous advocate for the programs that are in place, and I suspect that all the hospitals, there's physicians who are similar, so it's not that the Board of Medicine is in any way not supportive of this, it's obviously they have supported it, but I think it's unsafe. I'm going to go out and say it is absolutely unsafe to have change midstream in the practices we're talking about, because many of these physicians actually don't even know how to do the things that the pharmacists have been doing for years now, the newer physicians. So if there was a provision that gave relief to the hospitals, which again have been practicing until the new regulations, unlike community and other settings where collaborative practice had not even launched yet, so it's not difficult to stage it in the community settings where they never had a history of these kinds of programs. But in the hospitals in the district that have been operating this way, the history is long, deep, and profound in terms of patient care. And we are the ones now who have greater exposure, if you will, to the unintentional disruption of the care model in collaborative practice. And I'm not saying that at all, it's what was the intention, but that is what's happening. And I would like that to be part of the board's, in private conversations, but if it's going to stay like this, you're either you are going to unintentionally be facilitating care model changes that were not the intention of Board of Medicine or Board of Pharmacy.
So again, I do want to stress that it's a joint effort between medicine and pharmacy. And of course, a lot of the push has been from the Board of Pharmacy. because we're pharmacists and we know the value that we've been bringing to patient care for years and years and years, and we respect that we do need to work with our Board of Medicine colleagues. What I would suggest, and I hope it's okay to say this, but if people kind of usually have a higher regard sometimes when they get confirmation from their peers. And so just like you came and spoke with us, pharmacists to pharmacists, if there are physicians that are at your institution that really are concerned about the same hiccup that's now in your model of practice, and they want to write a letter or something that they could present to their physician colleagues on the Board of Medicine, I don't think there's anything that would stop you from doing that. Again, the members from the Board of Pharmacy that are on that task force, they are standing firm and saying, no, these are things that have been done. Pharmacists are fully capable of doing it, but it takes two to tango. And so I don't know if we can get some of our physician colleagues to kind of help support and express concern about what we're talking about today. Otherwise, it'll just continue to seem a bit self-serving that pharmacists are just trying to practice medicine.
I would offer up the recommendation that the case you made to the Board of Pharmacy, it'd be valuable to have you make that case directly to the Board of Medicine. The wisdom of legislation that requires two different professional boards to work together to enact regulations, some would perhaps question. In this case, that provision has only slowed us down and has only, from your comments, suggests me it's only compromised patient care. And I don't think that was the intent, but that's the reality, it sounds like. So I believe it'd be valuable for you to attend the next Board of Medicine meeting and make the case you just did. And AJ, do I understand you do something with the Board of Medicine?
Yeah, the next meeting is just in a couple of weeks. If you want to get on the agenda, just let me know.
I'll ask if maybe I'm president of our medical staff or the president of our hospital or the designated join me.
I think coming as a team will illustrate the way that pharmacy and medicine works together and the intent behind the legislation how the two boards work together. It's a good intent, but the reality of making it happen schedules this and that and different levels of priority assigned to it from one profession versus another, perhaps you can help push us to resolution, which on behalf of the Board of Pharmacy would say thank you if you could help make that happen.
I will definitely
make myself available. Wednesday April 24th, I think, is the next meeting at 8:30 a.m. Wednesday April 24th.
Okay. Here.
This room.
Same room. Okay. Wednesday, April 24th. Thank you. Any other comments? No? All right. Well, if we have no other public comments, we will entertain a motion to adjourn the open session. So if one of my great colleagues could make a motion, we'd greatly appreciate it. Page 4, very bottom. Take a deep breath.
I want to share it around.
That's a good job.
Madam Chair, I move the board to close open public session portion of the meeting and move into the closed executive session portion of the meeting pursuant to DC official code section 2-575B for the following purposes: to discuss disciplinary matters pursuant to section 2-575B9. To seek the advice of counsel to the board to preserve the attorney-client privilege or to approve settlement agreements pursuant to section 2-575B4 and to plan to discuss or hear reports concerning ongoing and planned investigation pursuant to same section 2-575B14.
Thank you. And so we'll take a roll call vote on the motion. I'll start. Daphne Bernard, I'm in favor of the motion.
James Appleby, I'm in favor of the motion.
Tamara McCann's in favor of the motion.
Shakita Sanders, in favor of the motion.
Benjamin Miles, in favor of the motion.
Okay, thank you. So this concludes the public open session of the meeting. The board will now move into the closed executive session portion of the meeting pursuant to DC Official Code 2-575B for the reasons set forth in the motion. And so we are adjourning open session at 10:39. Thank you, everyone. We'll see you all in June.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.